York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is going to be a very interesting program because we're going to have two attorneys on with a newsmaker update talking about the grand jury inquiry with the Department of Justice to reopen the investigation into the downing of the World Trade buildings on 9/11. A lot of research has gone into this. You'll find it interesting what they have found are going to reveal on this program today. Also in this program, we're going to have a guest, and that guest is Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern has worked in the intelligence agency at the CIA for 27 years, and he was a top CIA analyst for those years, serving under seven presidential administrations, from John F. Kennedy to George Bush. And he is going to be asked, does he believe that these recent gas attacks in Syria are due to Assad or false flag operations done by, well, let's see who he might project could do it, certainly the United States? And why is it that the entire media is complicit in supporting an intervention in Syria? We'll analyze this. And of all the people, not the dancing heads, the propagandists on MSNBC or CNN, but rather Tucker Carlson was the only person I could find in the media who said, stop a moment and look at what you're saying and look what that would mean, a military conflict in Syria. Because just yesterday, China said that it would support Russia in its Syrian operations. Do we really want a conflict in Syria that would engage Russia and China? I think not. So we're going to hear that little piece from Tucker Carlson today. We're going to hear from Ray McGovern, who's very well up to date on all this and showing all the false flags that have occurred, including the last two gas attacks in Syria. Neither was done by the Assad regime. They were done by the people we support, the so-called good beheaders, the good people that blow up buildings and kill children, are terrorists. And why has the media not done any exposés on 60 Minutes or 2020 or Nightline about our direct, unequivocal support for terrorists? It's just insane. And so those are two issues we're going to deal with today. But before we go there, we always try to look at the latest on health and healing and how to live a longer, healthier, and also a happier life. That said, uranium exposure is linked to increased lupus rate. This is from Science Daily. And people living near any form of uranium or processing facility, for example, in Ohio, they have them, in Montana, they have them, all around the United States, they're experiencing a higher than average rate of lupus. That's according to studies conducted at the University of Cincinnati as well as the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Now, let's say you're not aware of lupus, L-U-P-U-S. It's a chronic inflammatory disease that can affect the skin, the joints, the kidneys, the lungs, nervous system, and other organs of the body. And the underlying causes of lupus are not all known, but it's usually more common in women of childbearing age. And extensive review of the medical records and serum antibody analysis verify the cases concluded that people who were exposed to higher levels of uranium based on their living proximity to a former uranium ore processing plant had lupus rates 400% higher than the average population. Now, why is that important? Because right now, all the bullets and bombs and missiles that are being used in Iraq and Yemen and Syria, these in Afghanistan, these are all from depleted uranium, which is still extremely toxic. Now, not only is it causing Gulf War syndrome in the soldiers who are in tanks where the shells in the tanks are emitting this radiation into their body, they're coming home with defective organs and autoimmune diseases. And I've worked with a lot of them. Actually helped some reverse their Gulf War syndrome. And the government denies culpability because it would then be responsible not just for the American soldiers, which would be about maybe $2 trillion in long-term health benefits, but think of the tens of millions, actually hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East and in Africa where we've used this weapons, we'd be responsible for their environment. Because once you blow up a bullet and a bomb, you microcrystallize the atoms. They go everywhere. In fact, they've been shown to come as far as from Afghanistan and Iraq to England, the measurable amounts there. So that's a big issue. Separately, from the University of Alberta Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry, kids need at least 7 minutes a day of vigorous physical activity, but most are not getting it. Children need a minimum of 7 minutes a day, and that is demonstrated recently in findings by the university. And, quote, if you watch late-night television or look in the backs of magazines, you'll see magical ads saying you need just 10 minutes a day or 5 minutes a day of exercise to stay fit. And for those of us in the medical field, we just rolled our eyes at that. But surprisingly, they may actually be right, and that's what this research shows. Our research showed children don't need a lot of intense physical activity to get healthy benefits, and 7 minutes or more of vigorous physical activity was all that was required. But the 7 minutes had to be intense to prevent weight gain, obesity, and other adverse effects. And most kids were not even getting that, end quote. Well, my thoughts on that is that's intense exercise. Yes, where you really put it all out. But then we should have moderate exercise of 45 minutes a day. So if you do 45 minutes of power walking or biking with resistance or swimming, that's terrific for you. And then in that exercise, put about 10 minutes of vigorous. And you could do it in intervals, and that'll help. I was asked recently about these coatings, what we would historically call Teflon coatings, that keep food and from sticking to pots and pans. And these Teflon-like coatings, these non-stick frying pans, are everywhere. And what happens is when you put heat on them, they break down. Why? Because Teflon is the trademark name for a chemical, PTFE. And this chemical, which makes things not stick in its use of cookware, according to the good, should be classified as, quote, a likely carcinogen, meaning a cancer-causing substance. And this is according to advisors to the EPA. And but they haven't banned it. And that's unfortunate because you're getting this in so many ways. You're getting in cookware, clothes, pizza boxes, microwave popcorn bags. It's all going in your body, and that's not good. So avoid Teflon and all these no-stick by using stainless steel cookware. You can use glass as well. Both are terrific, but Teflon, stay away from it. The latest study shows that from medical news today, published in the journal Neurology, that Alzheimer's is just exploding in the baby boomer generation, and they're asking a question at the Rush Institute for Healthy Aging at Rush University Medical Center, Chicago. They're saying, what can be done about it? And the answer is, right now, we're not doing anything about it. We do not have a surgeon general. We do not have people within this administration or previous administrations that are saying, what can we do to prevent inflammation in the brain? That's the number one cause. You can look at the amyloid plaque all you want, but what causes that amyloid plaque is the issue. And for that, what we need is we need to take an honest look, which you're not going to get from any administration because of all the lobbyists for the groups that make those pro-inflammatory soft drinks, pizzas, hamburgers, hot dogs, french fries, bagels, toast. high sugary drinks, all causes inflammation, as well as caffeine. And medications cause caffeine, alcohol causes caffeine. So a lot of what a person takes in causes inflammation. That inflammation then impacts the brain, and then we look at a disease to help a person with the symptoms of Alzheimer's. And what we need to do is realize there's no help coming. Don't wait for the Surgeon General, the head of the U.S. Public Health Service, or anyone else to wake up one day and say, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to inform every one of the 900,000-plus doctors in America to spend at least 15 minutes with each patient each day advocating a no-inflammation lifestyle. Here's what causes inflammation. Give them a list. Here are the foods you shouldn't have. Here are the foods you should have that turn off inflammation. And we could do an enormous amount of good. I'm not even saying the nutrients that rebalance your brain chemistry. I'm just simply saying something that simple. Fortunately, you know what causes inflammation. From Ohio State University, zinc helps against infection by putting on the brakes in immune response. And new research suggests that zinc helps control infections by gently tapping the brakes on the immune response in a way that prevents out-of-control inflammation that can be damaging and even deadly. And scientists determine in human cell culture and animal studies that a protein lures zinc into key cells that are first responders against infection. Zinc then interacts with a process that is vital to the fight against infection, and by doing so helps balance the immune response. And this study revealed for the first time that zinc homes in on this pathway and helps shut down, effectively ensuring that the immune response does not spiral out of control. And so that's just one more way that zinc helps control sepsis, which is a devastating systemic response to infection that it'll commonly cause death in intensive care unit patients. Quote, we do believe that to some extent these findings are going to be applicable to other important areas of disease beyond sepsis. Without zinc on board to begin with, it could be devastating. So you don't need a lot of zinc each day, maybe 15 milligrams. That's it. But not just that, but according to Susan Patterson of the Natural Society, an article that was published in a peer-reviewed journal, quote, improve your immune function and boost your blood sugar regulation with zinc. This is a separate study, and it shows that zinc, which we know is a powerful trace element responsible for more than 300 enzyme functions, can counteract the negative effects of diabetes mellitus. And so anyone with prediabetes or diabetes should be using zinc each day. And, quote, zinc supplementation of animals and humans has been shown to ameliorate glycemic control in type 1 and type 2 diabetes, the two major forms of diabetes mellitus. Zinc seems to exert insulin-like effects by supporting the signal transduction of insulin and by reducing the production of cytokines, those are bad inflammatory reactors in your body, which lead to beta cell death during inflammatory processes in the pancreas in the course of disease. So in lay language, what this really means is that the pancreas is your body's endocrine system, part of it, and it's responsible for producing numerous hormones, including insulin. And the insulin is secreted by beta cells, B-E-T-A, beta, which must have high concentrations of zinc to work optimally. So if the cells are unable to store zinc due to beta cell tissue and polymorphism, type 2 diabetes may be the result. So when you have zinc, you're helping with diabetes. Also, from the Natural Society, a study on sleep. Most people, by the way, don't get a really good night's sleep, and that can impact your immune system, your attention, your cognition, your energy. Everything is impacted if you don't get good sleep. And sleep is extremely necessary for cellular rest and restoration. But without adequate sleep, the whole body suffers and health is impaired. And unfortunately, we seem to be living in an age where the majority of people are suffering from sleeplessness. And on college campuses, it's epidemic. And this sleeplessness can be especially troublesome for children in school, who need even more sleep than adults. Actually, adequate sleep is essential for a child's academic success. And school children who are sleep-deprived suffer from impaired judgment, poor memory, emotional instability, and decreased immune system functioning, according to the latest studies. And while you may think that 7 to 8 hours of sleep is plenty, adolescents actually need up to 9 hours of good sleep each night in order to perform their best. However, they are among the most sleep-deprived group in school statistics, and 60% of kids are not getting good sleep. And so it's not building healthy habits. No, why? Well, the two most common reasons, now even babies are getting those into the internet system. They're getting their own cell phones. Electromagnetic pulses. That's disrupting your brain chemistry, the pineal gland, the secretion of melatonin. And then they're sleeping with the cell phone under their pillows. Dare it be that they get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning and are not up for it. So take away all the tablets, turn off the computers, unplug it, the televisions. All these are emitting electromagnetic pulses, and or they're eating late at night, and that keeps their digestive cycle in an anabolic state, which is revving up, and yet the body's putting on the brakes, wanting to slow it down, and so they're disrupted in their sleep. And also reducing sodium in the United States could save hundreds of thousands of lives a year. And that's according to the American Heart Association, because less sodium in the diet could save about 280,000 to 500,000 lives over 10 years. And this was published in Hypertension. And a key finding of the study was that a gradual reduction in sodium consumption by 40% to about 2,200 milligrams a day over 10 years is projected to save 500,000 lives. I think that 2,200 milligrams a day is way too much sodium. Your body only really requires about 800 milligrams. So at 1,500 milligrams, you're going to be much better off. So reduce the intake of salt in the diet. And finally, pesticides in food and water and air can be a risk factor for developing type 2 diabetes, according to this new study done at the University of Granada in Spain. And it has a direct relationship between exposure of persistent organic pollutants, or COPs, in food, air, and water, and the prevalence of diabetes. This was published in Science Daily. And by the way, these COPs are a group of chemicals with diverse characteristics which are present in pesticides and industrial waste and building materials. And these compounds penetrate the body, not only mainly through food, but also through the air and skin. And that's not good. So we can do something about it. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. From all over the world where people are listening right now, I welcome you. We try to select information that can impact everyone, not just people living in North America, but everywhere. Right now, we're going to go over to Ray McGovern, who is standing by. But before we go to Ray McGovern, who's standing by, I want to play you a clip from Tucker Carlson. He did a short clip. It's only about 4.5 minutes. He was the only journalist that I could find who actually said, before we go off on this hair trigger campaign to inflict more damage in Syria, why don't we stop and ask ourselves, how do we know that the information that the media is disseminating is accurate? After all, we've had at least 3 previous gas attacks in Syria that have been shown now by Seymour Hersh and others to have been not by Assad's regime, but by the terrorists that we support, the so-called moderate terrorists, which itself is an oxymoron. And the media has not done an investigation into these people. The people we have on the program have. Our people have been in the war zone in East Aleppo when it was still held by terrorists, as showing that the white helmets were a terrorist group. America had given over $500 million to them. The Pentagon had a whole campaign around them. Hollywood gave them an Oscar for a short documentary. And it's a complete fraud. These are terrorists supporting terrorism. Why didn't the mainstream media, if I can get a journalist on to tell that story and document it, three separate journalists to tell that story, why can't the collective media with thousands of journalists and all the resources find the same information? Is it because they're self-censoring, don't want to find it, or being told by people who are embedded within their institutions or have impact over them that don't touch that story? But we're not getting the full truth. And then you'll hear what the people on the other liberal networks had to say about going in there right away. And didn't the former presidential campaign, Howard Dean, a medical doctor, was talking about electing him because he was an anti-war activist? And he is harping the loudest about going in, not just doing a one strike, but really regime change. And did anyone ever ask this? So we have some children who were exposed to gas. And we have a source in Great Britain that's supposedly the objective source, which is not. It's one person. And they're not in Syria. And they're getting their information from the white helmets. Well, if the information is coming from the white helmets, and we've seen they've used this same little kid in four separate terrorist attacks, rescuing the same kid from four attacks, this is being staged. We even got a video of them staging a setup to make it look as like this just happened and it didn't in a different location, and their so-called hospital was really where they were manufacturing their munitions and storing them. And now, here's Assad, who's won there, allowing the terrorists to leave on buses from this one little enclave near Damascus. And so he's got everything on his side. So he would then decide to go ahead and do a gas attack? No, that doesn't pass any test of credulity. And yet, if we go into Syria and start bombing, think how many kids are going to be killed. And is Bolton and these other neocons, are they considering the human toll on, and what model are they using? Are they using Libya? Is Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama saying, follow our model, you'll have a democracy afterwards? No, more slaves are being sold in the streets of Libya today than any other place on the continent. Does anyone take credit for that? No. Listen to Tucker Carlson, then we'll go to Ray McGovern.
Tonight, leaders on both sides of the aisle in Congress, in the media, in our intelligence services, in virtually every overfunded think tank in Washington, have suddenly aligned tonight on a single point of agreement. America must go to war in Syria immediately. Bashar al-Assad cannot continue to lead that country. He must be overthrown. Assad is an evil man, they tell us. His latest crime is a chlorine gas attack carried out over the weekend by his forces against a rebel-held suburb of Damascus. Assad's poison gas suffocated children. Pictures of the aftermath of that are all over the internet, and they are horrifying. Assad is a monster. That's the official story. Almost everyone in power claims to believe it. The push to war in Syria, by the way, has united politicians from both sides. Lindsey Graham and Howard Dean typically agree on very little. Not much at all. But today, they are both calling for war in Syria. Graham is demanding massive attacks on the Syrian military. Dean is going even further than that. On Twitter, he called the president, quote, a wimp for merely sending thousands of troops and launching tons of bombs at Syria. That's not enough for Howard Dean, who, as you may remember, once ran for president as the peace candidate. Tonight, he wants total war in Syria. Television pundits, of course, strongly agree. This morning, the foreign policy team over on MSNBC explained that it's far more important for American troops to fight in Syria than it is to secure our own border here in America. Watch.
There's no question that now, all these years later, it is Donald Trump's challenge. He has to take action. He's right. Spoken to Macron. What he ought to do is a coordinated action. There has to be a comprehensive response.
as Trump leaves to fight his imaginary border war, he's leaving the real war where we could make a difference, and said he's turning it over to Assad and to Iran and to ISIS. This is something that Barack Obama wouldn't even do if confronted with these set of facts.
Trump has to take action in Syria. Everyone nods sagely. That ought to make you nervous. Universal bipartisan agreement on anything is usually the first sign that something deeply unwise is about to happen, if only because there is nobody left to ask skeptical questions. And we should be skeptical of this, starting with the poison gas attack itself. All the geniuses tell us that Assad killed those children. But do they really know that? Of course they don't really know that. They're making it up. They have no real idea what happened. Actually, both sides in the Syrian civil war possess chemical weapons. How would it benefit Assad using chlorine gas last weekend? Well, it wouldn't. Assad's forces had been winning the war in Syria. The administration just announced its plans to pull American troops out of Syria, having vanquished ISIS. That's good news for Assad. And about the only thing he could do to reverse it and to hurt himself would be to use poison gas against children. Well, he did it anyway, they tell us. He's that evil. Please. Keep in mind, this is the same story they told us last April. Do you remember that? It was almost exactly a year ago. The new administration announced it was no longer seeking to depose Assad from power. Regime change was no longer our policy. So the usual war chorus in Washington started yelping, went berserk, and days later, Assad supposedly used sarin gas against civilians in Syria. There was video. We bombed a Syrian airbase in response to that. At the time, this show asked what seemed like the obvious question, are we really sure that Assad did that? It seems weirdly timed and counterproductive to him. Shut up, they explained. Of course we're sure. What an unpatriotic question. But of course they were lying. 2 months ago, the Secretary of Defense admitted that actually, we still have no proof that Assad used sarin gas last year. The story, it turns out, was propaganda. It was designed to manipulate Americans, just like so much of what they say. We've seen this movie before, and we know how it ends. But just for the sake of argument, let's assume they're not lying this time. Let's assume Assad did just use chlorine gas against kids. He's perfectly capable of that, by the way, not defending his moral character. Let's say he did do it. Would that be worth starting a new war over? Overthrowing Assad's regime in Syria would result in chaos. Many thousands would die. And in fact, we might likely see the genocide of one of the last remaining Christian communities in the Middle East, and we ought to care about that. Some of the dead, of course, would be American servicemen. A new war would cost us tens of billions of dollars, maybe hundreds of billions. Would it make America safer? Would it make the region more stable? Let's see. How exactly did regime change work in Iraq and Libya? Doesn't matter, say our moral leaders on CNN and everywhere else. Atrocities like this cannot be tolerated. Okay, but let's be real. We do tolerate atrocities like this all the time. For example, there's a devastating famine killing children in Yemen right now. The Saudis are causing that famine. Should we drop tomahawks on Riyadh in response? Not until it's on YouTube, apparently. When you conduct foreign policy by viral video, pictures are essential. But in real life, Syria is a highly complicated place. With Assad gone, who would run it exactly? Do we have another strongman in place to install? Or is it our hope that a stable democracy will magically appear in the wake of this protracted civil war? And who exactly are these moderate rebels you're always hearing about, the ones that we're supporting with your tax dollars? Well, a lot of them turn out to be Islamist crazies. For example, the city where the chemical attack just occurred is mostly controlled by the Army of Islam. It's a radical group that has called for establishing an Islamic state under Sharia law in Syria. That group's founder called for exterminating all Shia Muslims and Alawites from the country. But we're supposed to wage a new war on this group's behalf. Why is that exactly? Back in 2013, when the Syrian civil war was still in its early days, one onlooker weighed in on Twitter. Here's part of what he wrote, quote, "We should stay the hell out of Syria. The rebels are just as bad as the current regime. What will we get for our lives and billions of dollars? Zero." In another tweet, he said this, quote, "Let the Arab League take care of Syria. Why are these rich Arab countries not paying us for the tremendous cost of such an attack?" And in yet another tweet, he said this, "What will we get for bombing Syria beside more debt and a possible long-term conflict?" Of course, you know who wrote that. It was Donald Trump. And he was right. And that's one of the reasons he got elected president. And now the same people who brought you a dying American middle class, undefended American borders, and endless pointless wars in countries you could not find on a map are telling the president he's got to depose Assad for reasons that are both unclear and demonstrably dishonest. And by the way, it may happen. But before it does, Congress ought to consider a brand new constitutional amendment. Let's call it the Lindsey Graham Amendment. And here's what it would say. Congress shall topple no government until it finishes rebuilding the last government it toppled. And furthermore, talk show generals shall be required to personally visit the battlefield of every war they advocate for. End of amendment. That would have an immediate and positive effect. Let's hope it passes. Senator Roger Wicker.
By the way, I want to thank Tucker Carlson for having the courage and the character to tell the truth when no one else in the media would. And so good for him on this particular issue. Let's go over and say now hello to a person who's been on this program many times, and he's one of those truthsayers, Ray McGovern. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he was in Army intelligence. He was in the CIA as an analyst for 27 years. And so he has his pulse on what's happening. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be with you.
Ray, Trump sent a tweet this morning that can be easily interpreted as a direct military threat towards Russia. He tweeted, quote, Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming. Nice and new and smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it, end quote. And here is the problem. There is no certain evidence whatsoever that Assad gas militants or civilians in the city of Douma in Ghouta, a region near Damascus. And again, we discover the photos of victims posted by the white helmets that very likely are fake and has been shown to be the case in the earlier chemical weapons events being charged against the Syrian government. And Russia has tried to take the UN Council to task and try to say, look, this is probably a false operation. And reports of doctors out of Syria say they are not witnessing any victims of chemical weapons attack. There is no victims of chemical poisoning in the hospitals either. And this is another problem. The sole originating source of these attacks is consistently the White Helmets, a terrorist group that has been shown to be associated with Al-Qaeda and Sunni extremism, yet fully supported by the U.S., Hollywood, and Israel. And both Russia and Assad have been demanding that international inspectors through the UN and the Watchdog Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons go to Douma and assess the situation. And the U.S. and U.K. and France continue to create obstacles opposing a fact-finding mission. Now tensions between U.S. and Russia have probably never been higher now than except for during the Cold War and nuclear standoff in the 60s. In addition, Trump has leveled sanctions on Russia, and both sides are expelling each other's diplomats. So that is the lay of the land. So we welcome your commentary on the current state of affairs in this U.S.-Israeli alliance to invade Syria and Russia's current role in its efforts to ease tensions. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. As usual, you have touched on the main points here. The situation is more dangerous now with respect to Russia than it has been since I had entered on active duty as an Army officer, infantry, and intelligence right during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. I do not exaggerate. It's worse than then, because when President Kennedy was in charge, he had some sensible advisors. He had some crazy advisors. They were the military. They were Curtis LeMay, head of the Air Force, and so forth. But he was able to turn to Ambassador Llewellyn Thompson, who had been serving in the Soviet Union, and to his brother and other people who were more sensible. And we got out of that crisis without a whole bunch of people getting killed. Now, who does President Trump have at his side? A certifiable lunatic. His name is John Bolton. I do not exaggerate. I adduced in one of my recent articles a note that the first president, George H.W. Bush, to me, 2 months before the attack on Iraq by his son and Tony Blair. I had raised with the first President Bush, look, I was around. I was around and working for you when you kept the crazies at arm's length. You couldn't get rid of them because of the politics of the Republican right, but you kept them in positions of government where they were deputy assistant secretary or so forth, where they couldn't do any real harm to our country. Now, Mr. President, I see your son having brought them into office, and they're running things. Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, all these same people we used to call crazies. Could you do me a favor, I said, on the 11th of January, 2003, would you please tell your son why it was that you kept them at arm's length and the dangers of listening to them? Now, he wrote back, and this is what I scanned into my article. He said, well, Ray, you know, I too was a little concerned about, quote, the crazies, end quote. This is a handwritten note, okay? But and initial reports suggested they would have a hold of my son, but I'm not afraid because my son is great, blah, 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 blah. Okay, 2 months later, the crazies invaded Iraq and brought bedlam to that whole part of the world. So who was Bolton? Bolton was the guy who was Under Secretary of State for Arms Control, which took us out of, who took us out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which for 30 years, since 1972, had brought a balance of terror, a mutual assured destruction sort of situation between the Soviet Union and us, which was, you know, not ideal by any stretch, but it was stable. We got out of that treaty and introduced a degree of stability that had not existed since before President Nixon. So this is what the problem is. This is why we see Trump in that tweet that you mentioned this morning, daring the Russians to do what exactly they said they would do, and that is retaliate. Now, what Russians are saying then? Well, very important military Russians, and the head of the Duma. Now, the Duma is the Russian parliament. This is their parliamentary defense committee, so it's the equivalent of John McCain. The head of the Duma committee, Armed Services Committee, if you will, is a colonel general, just like a lieutenant general in our forces. He used to command the Russian airborne troops. What he said was this: Moscow will take all measures, including military ones, in response to a possible U.S. strike on government forces in Syria. The double standard policy has overstepped all possible boundaries. Not a single unlawful action will be left without response. And he continued, Americans, quote, should not pin hope on their Navy groups, end quote. We have allies, and we're guarantors of the events that are taking place in Syria since we've been invited in and you have not. So what am I saying here? I'm saying batten down the hatches, Gary. This is very, very serious, because if Trump is egged on by the likes of Bolton, the crazies, certifiably crazy, and launches an attack on Syria as he did last April, April 4th. Now, I'm really glad you played that clip from Tucker Carlson, whom I also admire. I hope they let him stay on. Now, what he talked about was the 4 April event of last year, which was a canard. Now, there are lots of things wrong with that that latest mouse-trapping event where, again, Bashar al-Assad was being accepted by high-level U.S. policymakers, including the Secretary of Defense, say, well, maybe we'll let him stay in office. Okay, so what happens? Well, there's a chemical event in Idlib province, and guess what? Well, you know, let me compare it to this. In some of the Shakespearean tragedies, there's something called an anachronism. What does that mean? Well, it means that you have an alarm going off, okay? Well, there were no alarms going off in the 15th, 14th century about which he wrote, okay? So what happened? Well, the so-called victims of this gas attack in April of last year showed up at the hospitals hours before the suspected plane overflew that area and supposedly dropped sarin gas. Now, that's an anachronism. I would say even more, that's an incongruity that speaks volumes. You had the victims appearing at hospitals before the so-called sarin was dropped. That's what happened in April, early April of last year. So what we have here is a whole bunch of what we intelligence specialists used to call false flags attacks. To the layman, we call them mousetrapping the president. And we're not real sure whether President Trump is being mousetrapped or whether he's simply being led by the nose by the likes of Bibi Netanyahu. Now, why do I say that? Well, I say that because he was in touch. Well, Bibi Netanyahu called him up real quick as soon as Trump said, well, you know, maybe we get out of, yeah, let's get out of, let's take our troops out of Syria. Well, we know. And Netanyahu has bragged about having turned the president around. And what does that mean? Well, that means that what we have here is the same kind of situation that we had way back in almost 5 years ago. Now, I reference this because this, too, has to do with so-called sarin attacks by Bashar al-Assad. Now, it's worth reviewing this because it is only 5 years ago, and it was not, and I repeat, not played in the U.S. press in the way it was. This is what happened. On August 20th.
Ray, talk directly into the telephone.
Sure. Okay, yeah. On August 20th, 2012, Barack Obama was given a piece of paper at the end of a press conference. And the media said, is there anything else? Oh, yeah, there's this. I've been saying we're not going to intervene militarily in Syria, but if the Syrians threaten to use or actually did use chemical weapons, then I would change my calculations. Okay, mark the date, August 20, 2012. August 21st, 2013, after a decent interval, guess what happens? The rebels are accused of using sarin gas and killing about 1,300 people in the suburb of Damascus called Ghouta. Now, what did we find out about that? Well, as Obama was being egged on to retaliate to get the U.S. involved directly in that war, General Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was given a note from his opposite number in the U.K. Now, this is important because Porton Down, the chemical research facility that is run by the U.K. military, had found out that the sarin used on this August 21, 2013 event was not, I repeat, was not the same sarin gas that was known to be in Syrian government stocks. It was homemade gas. Now, General Dempsey told that to the president. We told the president we had sources that indicated that the Turks and others had facilitated the precursors into that part of Syria and probably were the ones responsible for the attack. The top came on the pudding, so to speak, on December 10th, when Aaron Erdem, a parliamentarian in the Turkish parliament, testified under oath that there were court proceedings in southern Turkey against seven smugglers were responsible for smuggling in the precursors for sarin and were responsible for that attack. Now, Americans don't know that unless they read the Belfast Telegraph on December 10th, 2015. Okay. Well, now who reads the Belfast Telegraph? Well, not very many people, not even in Belfast. It was shut out. The U.S. media, and unless you read Turkish, you're completely oblivious of the fact that under oath, these Turkish parliamentarians revealed that it was the Turks and other friendly intelligence services that were responsible for that first attack with sarin that was blamed on Bashar al-Assad. Now, what did Obama say about this? This is really interesting. He waited a couple of years. 2 years ago, he was interviewed by the equivalent of his biographer so far, Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic, Atlantic magazine. And Jeffrey said, well, what do you think about that chemical attack in everybody blamed Bashar al-Assad? You know what Obama said? He said, look, he said, you know, I'm really, really happy that I restrained myself and I didn't do, for example, what Trump later did in April of last year, that is, fire cruise missiles into Syria. He said, the reason I'm happy about that is because we found out lots of other things about this. And here, I'll tell you this, Jeffrey, he says, that last week in August, after the attack, and when people were goading me on to attack Syria militarily, the head of national intelligence visited me in my office. It was sort of unannounced. It was James Clapper. And he said, now, Mr. President, I have a lot of respect for John Kerry and your Secretary of State. And I know that, you know, I know that he said 35 times that Bashar al-Assad was guilty of the sarin attack on the 21st of August, 2013. But, Mr. President, how do I say this? Well, I'm the head of your intelligence apparatus, and you know, I guess I'll say it this way. It's not a slam dunk, Mr. President. I guess that's the best way. It's not a slam dunk. Now, who do we have that from? We have that from Barack Obama. So here's the head of his intelligence saying it's a crock, and that's what we have here. That's what we have here with people who, like Bibi Netanyahu, want to make sure that there's no peace in Syria. Now, I'd like to finish with an explanation for those confused Americans who can't figure out why Syria would be such a threat to the United States that we would have to get involved in these kinds of things. And the answer is, very simply, Syria is not in any way a threat to the United States. But Israel perceives Syria as a place where the more chaos happens, the better. That is precisely why Bibi Netanyahu said, Mr. President, you can't get out of Syria. You need to get in there. And why these so-called chemical attacks occurred. Now, you don't have to believe McGovern for this. Gary, I'm fond of citing a New York Times article of September 6, 2013, where it becomes clear that under the Netanyahu government, Washington became deeply engaged in Syria. And the reporter, Jody Ruderman, now, she was a new head of the Jerusalem base there for the New York Times, and she's writing from Jerusalem, and she says, you know, here's the title, Israel backs limited strike against Syria, end quote. Whoa. Well, you know, talk about deja vu. That's what we have today. Now, what did she say? She said, I went and talked to high-level Israeli officials, and it was an introductory thing because, you know, I was new, and they were very hospitable. And what I found out was this, verbatim, quote, for Jerusalem, the status quo in Syria, horrific as it may be from a perspective, seems preferable to either a victory by Bashar al-Assad's government or his Iranian backers or the rebels. This, quote, this is what they told him. This is a playoff situation, okay, Jody, in which you need both teams to lose, but at least you don't want either to win. We'll settle for a tie, said Alon Pinkas, who was a former Israeli consul general in New York. Quote, let them both bleed. Let them both hemorrhage to death. That's the strategic thinking here. As long as this lingers, there is no real threat from Syria to Israel. That explains 90%
Ray,
of it.
I appreciate you coming on and making sense of this. And one last thought I want to share with you is that why is the American media completely silent on 30,000 unarmed, peaceful demonstrators from Palestine marching? And when there were over 1,000 people, it was originally 700 shot. Now the number of wounded is up to 2,000. And many of those shot were and hurt or killed were children. Not a word about the children killed, where it's unequivocal. We see it. The evidence is there. And not a word of criticism towards the government there of shooting unarmed people, including all the civilians and the children. It's just utter hypocrisy. Ray, thank you very much for coming on.
You're most welcome, Gary.
Ray McGovern. Now we're going to take you to a different story, a very important story, and we're going to have two lawyers on. The first is David Maischwinkel. He is a criminal defense attorney practicing in New Jersey and the current secretary and board member of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and president of the New Jersey 9/11 Aware, an educational group trying to increase awareness of the scientific and forensic evidence behind 9/11. He is also the co-founder of Quantum Matrix Alternative Media and a host on there. And he also is a retired police officer, Army veteran. And it's nice to have you with us today. Thanks for being on, David.
Thank you, Gary.
All right, David, and we'll have your partner here on in a moment, and he is Mick Harrison. And Mick is executive director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and he is currently the lead attorney in the petition filed yesterday with the Department of Justice demanding a grand jury investigation into the collapse of Buildings 1, 2, and 7 at the World Trade Center. And the petition includes evidence that explosives were used to bring down the towers in Building 7. And he has specialized in environmental and whistleblower cases for the Government Accountability Project. So I also welcome you, Mick, to the program.
Thank you, Gary.
So we're going to start here with the first question going out, and then you can answer in response. Why is it that we have not had a grand jury investigation since you have so much evidence showing inconsistencies between the official report and what evidence you now have that could challenge that report?
That's a good question. David, do you want to start or shall I?
Sure. Gary, I think that's the nature of our system now, unfortunately. The integrity of democracy in the United States is what's on trial here, really. This is sort of the last hope for the people to have some justice in this issue. It was never looked at properly, never examined. What has happened now with the Lawyers Committee getting involved, we've been able to compile the available evidence and sort of condense it into this document so that when it's presented to the grand jury and actually presented to the U.S. attorney, they must be impressed with the lucidity of it and the coherence of it and the truth that rings through it, that certainly there is a need for an investigation. We feel there was never really a proper investigation into the worst crime that ever was perpetrated on the United States public. So we think there's a little different now. There's a little more time that's passed. And the evidence, as I said, is now condensed, and it's there. They have a requirement, that's the U.S. attorney, to present this evidence to the grand jury. And I'd like to point out the grand jury is people like those that are listening today, that they will have an opportunity to examine this evidence and then take it where it will lead them. And hopefully it will lead them to those who were responsible for these terrible crimes.
And Gary,
okay, Mick, hold one second, please. For all of our stations that we normally sign off at 55, including our sister station WBI in New York, we're going to continue this up to the end of the hour. So if you want to continue carrying us, fine. But if not, then I understand that you have to cut us off at a certain time. But PRN, we will continue. Now, Mick, here's what I need you to do very succinctly.
Yes,
I need you to run down the new information that is compelling enough that would convince a grand jury that we have evidence to indict some people, the Saudis, whoever. Go down that list of information you have that we may not be aware of.
All right. So the evidence we presented in the grand jury starts with chemical analysis from professional laboratories of the dust from the Trade Center. In the dust were found these red-gray chips, which were analyzed and found to be active, what we call thermitic material, which means thermite or thermate, which is a high-tech explosive and incendiary. So to a layperson, there was evidence of explosive material found in the dust. So we're starting with that. Then we go to the firefighters' testimonies, and a lot of folks don't know this, but a lot of the firefighters who survived the 9/11 attack were interviewed on the record by the New York Fire Department to preserve their knowledge and recollection shortly after 9/11. those interviews were obtained by the New York Times through FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, and were published. And we went through those interviews, and also Graham McQueen, a researcher, went through those interviews. And the short version is, many of those firefighters reported the sights and sounds of explosions just as if they would have expected, and we would have expected, if there had been a controlled demolition that we're used to seeing for old buildings that had to be brought down. So you got the firefighters saying, we saw and heard explosions. You got dust evidence saying explosives were present. You got professional scientists, architects, engineers, physicists looking at the collapse of the buildings, and we've included a lot of their testimony. And they noticed that the features of a controlled demolition, meaning by use of explosives, are all present. You see a sudden onset. You see a symmetric collapse. You see the timing in the case of World Trade Center 7. But part of that collapse, it was an actual free fall, which means acceleration at the speed, at the rate of gravity. And that can only happen if there's absolutely no resistance from the floor underneath the point of collapse. And that can only happen if someone has artificially removed that resistance by use of explosives. That's how controlled demolition works. Now, there also have been found molten metal. We got a video of this. And you don't get molten metal, molten iron, molten steel without extreme temperatures. A lot of folks don't understand this. Jet fuel doesn't burn at a high enough temperature to melt steel or iron. But thermite or thermate, these high-tech explosive incendiary materials, they actually do their job by extreme temperatures. They create very extreme temperatures, and they do melt through steel. They cut through it almost like butter. That's how they're designed. So there's also seismic evidence, Gary. There was a laboratory, I believe, in Maryland, and it noted seismic events around the time of the airplane crashes at the Trade Center. But when you look closely at the timing, you see that the seismic events are not at the same time as the aircraft crashed into the Trade Center towers, as reported in the 9/11 Commission report. And then the question is, which came first? And the seismic reports say the seismic impact, the seismic signal came first. And that's corroboration that there was, in fact, an explosion early at the Trade Center, and maybe more than one before the plane impacts. So when you put these pieces of evidence together and you combine it with some very suspicious information, which is that a lot of the firefighters reported having advanced knowledge that Building 7 was going to collapse before it collapsed. And as you may know, there was actually a report in the BBC and a similar one with CNN. The BBC reporter actually said that Building 7 had collapsed, and you can see on the screen in the background that Building 7 was still standing at that time. So there was a premature report of collapse. So you take all these pieces of evidence together, and there are a few more, which I won't belabor, but if folks want to see the details, and I encourage them to, you know, go to our website and read the entire petition. And all the exhibits are available there. Just click on a link and they pop up. And our website there is lcfor911.org. So that's the short version of the new evidence. I should point out, we're not in the moment pointing fingers at a particular accused, a particular suspect. In other words, we're not naming names. We're defining the crime, proving the crime, asking the grand jury to investigate and determine who may be responsible.
All right, here's what I would do. I appreciate the overview here, but both David and Mick, I would like you to come back and do a press conference on the air on our Progressive Commentary Hour. You'll have a full hour. This way you can lay out all of your evidence that you would present to a grand jury to a worldwide audience. The largest progressive radio audience in the world is this show.
Sure.
And that way, we just got the overview now, and we understand it. And we understand you're moving to get the Justice Department to impanel a grand jury, which it can do. I'm just not confident that, as corrupt as the Justice Department is, that they're going to say yes. So let's go ahead and get the worldwide public involved by getting them to put pressure and write in their legislators and write to Justice Department insisting upon a grand jury. But you let Richard Gale, our executive producer, know if you want to do a one-hour press conference on the air with the new information compelling information and completely forensically solid information on a grand jury.
We would be delighted to do that, Gary. Appreciate the invitation.
Thank you, Gary. We'll have you on probably next Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. Mick Harrison, thank you for coming on and being a part of our program today. And also, I want to mark as well. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. And by the way, before we go, give your website, give us your email address.
Yes, the website is www.lcfor911.org. And you can email info@lcfor911.org.
Thank you. David Meiswickel, we appreciate being on, too. Thank you all for listening, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Have a nice day.